We'll get underway. Hearing on designations, my name is Paul Rogers, as you can see from the week signed up front, and I've been appointed to hear submissions and in some cases decide outcomes for designations. So this morning we're going to be hearing from people concerned with the Glenorchy aerograph.
Yes.
Right, okay, so just some introductions, please.
Yes, I'm Jane Little.
Ah, yes.
I'm a solicitor for Skydrive Queenstown, has made a submission. And we've produced evidence from Mr. Peter Buxley.
Yes.
He's here with me today. After my written submission, I'll invite him up. And also Ms. Vicky Jones, who's produced planning evidence. And I've got Mr. Clark Scott, who is the general manager of the company, with me as well, in case there are any other questions that you might have that he might be well placed to answer.
Alrighty, good, thank you. Okay, and we've got some legal submissions to begin with.
Yes, I have, and I've also handed up a bit of a case book, which you should have. Just for ease of reference, it's got a copy of the submission, further submission, and I'll just refer to that as I go through my Skydrive Queenstown filed a submission and further submission to the plan, and it submitted that the description of the designation should correctly reflect the purpose under the Reserves Act, as local purpose reserve rather than recreation reserve aerodrome, which had been notified. It submitted that planning that 25A should be amended to show the whole of the reserve being subject to the designation, and that's in accordance with what was notified in the description, Glenorchy Aerodrome Section 11 ESO Plan 443869. And I've just made a note there that aerodrome is defined in Chapter 2 of the proposed district plan. So it has one and two of my casebook there. I've just, for ease of reference, provided a copy of Skydive's submission and also the definition page from the proposed plan. There's a definition there of aerodrome. Given that the plan was notified with that description or definition term, aerodrome, Skydive submitted that the area of the designated footprint should include not just the land for the takeoff and landing of aircraft, but also land used for surface movement of aircraft, parking, loading, refueling, and the like. In its further submission, which I've included at tab 3, Skydive opposed the release that had been brought by the Wailuna Preserve Residents Association, which will be hearing from them after us, I believe. And they were seeking conditions to be imposed on the designation. And Skydive submitted that control to better administered under the Reserve Act regime to which the Glenorchy Aerodrome and its use as a subject. I've just made a footnote there. The Reserve Management Plan for the airstrip was adopted by the Council on the 24th of August this year. Skydive seeks an expanded footprint for the designation in general accordance with the plan appended to Mr. Buckley's evidence. Hopefully you received a colour copy of that plan, because if it's black and white, it probably looks like we're asking for the whole of the reserve to be included in the designation.
Yes, I've got a couple of copies.
Yeah, so essentially the highlighted strips, I suppose, show approximately the extent of where Skydive says the boundary of the destination should lie. That footprint will allow the following activities, all of which are within the scope or ambit of the two aerodrome, and which occur on the site now and could reasonably be anticipated to occur in accordance with the objectives that are expressed in the management plan. And again, I've just made a footnote there. The functions and duties of the requiring authority in this case devolve from the Reserve Act classification of the land, the objectives and policies of the management plan assist the requiring authority to carry out functions under the Reserves Act. The evidence supporting the requiring authority to the Scalabazi, in fact, the Reserve Management Plan sets out the objectives and policies for the management and development of the aerodrome. In accordance with Mr. Buckley's plan, the types of activities that will occur within the designation are the new access road that will come from the Grenalty Road, car park, the airstrip proper, the area alongside the airstrip and parking, loading, unloading, refueling of all aircraft, the helicopter landing pad, the parachute landing area, future hangars and toilets, an operational access road and wind box. In all other respects, guidelines support the amendment to the designation that has been recommended in the section 42A report. Just legal requirements, statutory considerations will be well known to the observer and they've been set out in the synopsis of the legal submission for sure that they refer to a narrow which refers to the relevant paragraph of the submission which has been filed, so I'm not going to repeat them here. And Ms. Jones fully traverses the requirements of section 168A in her evidence. I should just make a note there, I apologise, I gave Ms. Jones the wrong reference when I was checking the evidence. She referred to section 161, but of course we're dealing with 168A here as the territorial authority, as the requiring authority. Section the same consideration. The designation is thought to be rolled over in the plan, not a new designation. And I say this is of significance because when considering the effect on the environment of allowing the requirement as a baseline for life established by activities that have been lawfully established pursuant to the designation, and that must be borne in mind when considering what any additional conditions can or should be imposed on the designation. And I've just attached also in my case book a decision of the Environment Court in Beagle and the Minister for Corrections that explains here. And that decision runs to over 200 pages, so I haven't put the whole case in there, but I have just included an excerpt from that case where it discusses the permitted baseline. And that case concerned an application by the Minister to establish a new corrections facility in the Northland region. And three appeals were filed with the court, and the case involved three issues. Essentially whether the proposal recognised and provided for the relation to the Ngauri and the cultural traditions, whether the site was suitable given its location next to a geothermal field, and whether adverse effects on social and economic well-being of the local community as a result of prisons being there were appropriate. In the end result, the notice was confirmed, but during the course of the appeal, an issue arose as to whether a submitted baseline comparison was appropriate in that case with respect to first of all the regional consent that required and then the notice of requirement. And the court considered that from paragraph 988, considering whether the law obliged them to make the submitted baseline comparison. It noted that neither the Act nor case law has stated whether the obligation to make the comparison extended to designation requirements. It then explored or repeated the argument potentially in favour of the fact argument that the submission baseline should apply by the relevant council in that case. And they concluded it paragraph 1002. As there was no submission to the contrary, for the present case we accept the obligation to apply the submission baseline comparison extends to application for both regional consent and designation requirements. I should say that in Jordan's commentary where it mentions this case, it does record the fact that there weren't any arguments to the contrary, but I suppose this hasn't really been tested in any great depth in that sense. That the permitted baseline that the court was talking about in that case was pre codification. So it was envisaging three scenarios, activities that will also be established on the site, and discusses this in paragraph 989, activities that have been approved by an earlier consent, and then activities that were committed by rules and plan. The court went on at paragraph 1004. The purpose of the comparison is to consider whether the environmental effects of the proposal exceed a putative baseline of acceptable environmental effects that are inferred from the existing lawful activities. And I say that's quite an apt description of what a comparison would be in this case. Going back to my submission paragraph 7, I liken it to a comparison of effects. If the designation were removed from section 10.1, unfortunately tab 5, I meant to include section 10, but I've put section 9 in there, which isn't much help to you from the RMA, but I'm sure you will be reading section 10.1b, existing use rights apply in respect of uses that were lawfully established by way of designation and the effects of the use are the same or similar in character, intensity and scale to those which existed or the designation was removed. Skydive submission that the existing level, intensity and scale of use now established is the appropriate starting point when considering effects. No condition can or should have the effect of requiring any lesser effect, and nor I submit is in the jurisdiction for you to require that. I return scope later in these submissions, but note here the submission from Wayuna, and I'll set that out at tab 6 in my casebook. Wayuna seeks that the scale, nature and intensity of use of the aerodrome shall be maintained at the level of use as at the 26th of August 2015, and the significance of that date, such as this, is the date of their submission to the plan. In essence, this is a recognition of the starting point I've just described, an existing use right from the baseline proposition of the life. And I've noted that Ms. Galabazi for the council is requiring authority, and her evidence at paragraphs 839 and 849 takes a similar approach. Moving on to Skyline, Skydive's release extending the footprint of the designation. Skydive originally thought the footprint extends the totality of the reserve, having considered the operational requirements of the aerodrome and based on the evidence of Mr. Buckley, it seeks a smaller footprint, as outlined above. The footprint reflects the current and future anticipated operational requirements of the aerodrome and its users. Skydive submits with respect to the evidence for the requiring authority that QLEC's approach is somewhat short-sighted and naive given the nature of the designated activity being an aerodrome and the existing activities at the aerodrome. None of the matters thought by Skydive necessarily provide for an increase in capacity or intensity of use of the aerodrome, so in that sense they are consistent with the objectives of the requiring authority as derived from the reserve management plan. The change is thought a common sense and normal operational measures that should be included in a designation for an aerodrome. One of the council's stated objectives they set out in the reserve management plan is to encourage consolidation of structures and facilities, and this can be facilitated within a larger designation footprint. And the plan of Henry Smith's evidence demonstrates how that could happen. While QLDC itself might not have plans to undertake any future works in the short to medium term, whether that be access roading or structures, QLDC nonetheless has financial responsibility for the work, and it doesn't automatically follow that the council has to fund and carry out works within the designation. And there have been many instances in the district where works authorised pursuant to a designation have been undertaken and funded by a lessee or a licensee. I've just referred to footnote a couple of examples. A recent one was the Aristotle Sports Facility, where the council is the holder of that designation and the lessee, which is a charitable trust, pursued the notice of requirements in that case and will fund and undertake the construction. Also, I'm aware of construction of hangars and other aerodrome-related infrastructure at Wallonga Airport. Again, the council holds that designation and work, as I understand it, authorised pursuant to the outline development plan process. So again, that sort of goes to the short-sightedness, if you like, and perhaps the lack of understanding and long-term vision or planning in regards to the aerodrome at Glen Orchard. Ms. Jones has pointed to evidence extending the footprint of the designation will achieve the objectives of the plan by encouraging the consolidation of replacement structures and buildings in one area. And she undertakes a comprehensive analysis of the planning process of finding the extra proper designated. She has a table with her evidence describing the consents that would be required for activities outside the airstrip, but otherwise within the definition of aerodrome. There's no comparable analysis by the requiring authority, nor has it undertaken any operational or infrastructural assessment of existing users. And I submit that Ms. Jones and Mr. Buckley's evidence would be preferred. Just turning to wider submission and scope for additional control. It might be handy here to have Mr. Ferguson's statement of evidence before you. Particularly at page 14 where he sets out the revised release that's been brought by Wyoming.
Sorry, what was that reference again?
Page 14. The essence of the submission from Wyuna is that conditions should control the level of use of the aerodrome to a similar level to what presently occurs as at the date of the submission. And the submission continues at paragraph 416, asking the council to clarify the scale, nature and intensity of the existing operations by providing the number of approved operators flights per day per annum. Following that same theme, paragraph 417 of the submission requests a specific condition limiting the scale, nature and intensity of the use as at the 26th of August 2015 by inserting a maximum number of flights. I say, cutting across this, what Wayne is essentially asking for is a limit on the number of flights and flight paths. Flight more than any conditions that the Commission might be minded to impose can't go further than Wayne's submission. And again, rather than unnecessarily provide you with screens of paper, I've just included behind tab 8 relevant legal submissions that the council presented during hearing stream 1 relating to legal principles and case law regarding scope. That sort of contains the latest application and reference to the law on scope, and again, I'm sure you'll be more than familiar with that.
Right, thank you.
I say to go outside the way the submission would be required and clearly unfair to any potential submission of such views of the aerodrome, so not as much as that. Could be affected by any great restriction and second in ways of submission. And my concern here is reinforced by reference to Mr. Hunt's evidence, and he's giving evidence for Wayuna, where he says he's read a submission on designations by Skytrek, tandem hang gliding and paragliding, and that's at paragraph 2.5a of the evidence. Now I can't find any submission on designations by that company. The only submission I could find was lodged by Skytrek Tandem Limited. I've included that just for reference at tab 7. That submission relates to informal airports. It's got nothing to do with the designation at the Glen Orchard Aerodrome. perhaps Mr. Hunt may have been referring to a submission made to the management plan, but it really heightens the concern that what is proposed by Waiver in their release does go beyond their submission, and people aren't necessarily going to have noticed that. And the additional controls and measures proposed by Mr. Hunt regarding the aerodrome would doubtless affect operation from companies such as SkyTrek, given that evidence is particularly targeted to the effects of the activities they operate. That's the tandem paragliding operation that he discusses in his evidence, and I've given you a reference there. There are three conditions that Wayne seeks that I submit that are outside the scope of their original submission, and these are as follows, and with reference to Mr. Ferguson's evidence there. He suggests a limitation or redefinition of the purpose of the designation, and that's on this page 14. I say there's nothing in Wayne's submission that seeks to limit the term, that term is, sorry, the designation rather, was notified with the description of Glenorchy Aerodrome. There's nothing in Wayne's submission and it seeks to limit that term as defined in the plan or the purpose of the designation as an aerodrome. This part of the release is beyond the scope of Wayne's original submission. Likewise, under the heading restriction on aerodrome activities, there's a condition supporting to restrict the use of the aerodrome under the heading building. I say that's beyond the jurisdiction of Wayuna's submission. Wayuna, by its submission, thought that the existing scale and nature of the aerodrome be maintained, and that existing in scale, and, sorry, the existing scale and nature includes buildings and aerodrome. So the restrictions they seek, I say, are somewhat the antithesis of their submission. The requirements for a noise management plan. Mr. Hunt advocates for a condition imposed in the noise management plan. And condition 4A is of particular concern from a jurisdictional perspective, and that's set out at the top of page 15 of Mr. Ferguson's evidence. And I set out there clause 4A, and I emphasise the restriction does not exceed LDN 55 dB. Mr. Hunt says that by arbitrarily capping daily movements to current levels, the council could well be authorising an unacceptable level of aircraft noise. For example, approved building platforms being exposed to noise at levels above the 55 or even 65. LDN DB. That sounds two warning bells for me. That Mr. Hunt has not appreciated the effect scope of his client's submission, which is to maintain character intensity and scale at current levels. And that the limitations proposed in the noise management plan condition may well have the effect of reducing the level of activity or use below that which is existing. Something that could not, in my submission, have recently been anticipated from Wayuna's submission to the proposed plan. And I just make a note that Ms. Holden and Ms. Jones share similar concerns. Ms. Holden says paragraph 7.69 to 7.70, and Ms. Jones at paragraph 8.2. And actually, Ms. Galazzi as well at paragraph 8.49. The fallback position then is, of course, Wayuna's submission, which then seeks to impose specific controls on the number of operators and flight numbers, and I addressed that next. Controls and the designation versus the reserve management plan. Mr. Ferguson and Ms. Jones described the process for the reserve management plan in the evidence. They both obtained copies of that plan. Skylab agrees with evidence the QLDC regulatory and will require an authority that it's not necessary or desirable to duplicate the reserve management plan controls and restrictions in the designation. just put a reference to the evidence there in my footnote. Liz Jones expresses a similar opinion. The RMP provides a process to manage and control the effects of aircraft movements by quantifying the level of existing use. And the type of information the council is requiring to qualify its use includes demonstrated evidence of current and historic use of the aerodrome. And I've set out there a number of information or requests it's seeking. And this isn't in the front of my case book. I think I've provided you with a copy of a letter from a letter from Ms. Galavazzi to Skydive, and they are now in the process of the reserve management plan of looking to issue leases or licenses to operators, and you can see in that letter the type of information that they are requesting from current commercial operators so that they can quantify the level of current use consistent with the reserve management plan, which seeks to maintain that current level of use going forward. The information is well capable of establishing a reliable factual basis for existing use, and more particularly the levels of it. And I accept that while the RMP is not a statutory planning document under the RMA, nonetheless a statutory instrument which the council, in exercising its functions, must comply. I cited there the Reserves Act, section 41.11, which deals with management plan and says the administering body shall, in the exercise of its functions, comply with the management plan for the reserve. This is not a case, as Mr. Ferguson suggested, as evidence where there will be unfettered use of the designated land. And I don't accept as evidence that it's clear that the reserve management plan seeks to rely on future conditions in the designation to address effects relating to noise. The action back to page 8 of the reserve management plan, as far as the district plan is concerned, seeks to ensure the designation provision is appropriate and aligned with the reserve management plan. I say there's nothing in the reserve management plan or RMA or any case law I can find that diminishes or makes redundant the proposition on the part of Skyline and QLSC that the two processes, the designation of the RMA and the RMP, can't work together and complement each other. The RMP contains an effective and enforceable regime where it can control and manage the effects of noise by limiting the lease and license process to the scale and intensity of flight concurrently with use. There's no need to duplicate that process in my submission by imposing conditional designation. Just for completeness, I've included one last case in my case book. The only relevant case that I can find that discusses the relationship between the Resource Management Act and management plans under the Reserves Act. I have put it in there just for completeness, but I don't think it's particularly useful or relevant to the situation that presents us here today. It concerns a resource consent application and the weight that the court should be giving to management plan in that case, was considering that application. So those are my list of submissions, and I'm happy to answer any questions before I publish it up there.
All right. Thank you very much. Firstly, can we just talk about the extension, if you like, of the designation and discuss that topic?
Yes.
Wauna might take the point of view that, well, if the designation were to be extended and buildings and other facilities included by way of the designation, then that's just going to make it easier to make use of the facility. That's going to result in an increased level of activity, and that's going to cause or exacerbate the concerns that they allude to in terms of aircraft noise. What's your view to that particular proposition?
Well, I suppose that's another concern on their part. I guess what we're saying is that Waiata can rely on these restrictions that are in the Marine Goods Management Act, which seeks to control the level of use, quite specifically, I might say, to the current level of activity.
Mm-hmm. I understand and I read these elements in the management plan, but perhaps the challenge is that the tools to implement those controls are currently sort of being both developed and given effect to. The letter that you've provided me with exhibits that point, like ultimately the way that I've read the background documents, controls will find their way of expression in leases or licences or matters of that sort, and that's yet to take place, isn't it?
That's correct, yes.
So we've got this kind of nebulous statement at the moment that, if you like, insofar as levels of activity, control will be to current levels of activity, but nobody seems to know precisely what those current levels of activity are.
That's right.
So, I don't mean any criticism by this, these things happen, but it's a little unfortunate that the licences or leases or whatnot haven't sort of been gotten on with, so we've got some definitive controls.
I guess the point I've been trying to make is, whilst we don't know what that level of use is, it is ascertainable, and there are, if you like, there is a baseline or something that's right attached to it.
Yes, no, I understand that. Can you help me just with a bit of history then around sort of baseline related issues? When did the Waiuna preserve or development originate, and how did it originate? Is it by way of consents, or is it by way of sort of a zoning outcome? And who came along first, Aerodrome or Waiuna?
And I can be corrected by Ms. Galloway Baker when she appears before you and she's sitting in the back, but my understanding is that the Aerodrome predated the Waiuna development. And my understanding is that the Waiuna development came about as a result of a rezoning when the council promulgated its first district plan under the RMA, and I believe it has a rural lifestyle, which is a type of rural residential zoning, and development has taken place pursuant to that.
Yeah, and there are the building platforms and whatnot identified within that zone.
I don't believe the zone was so specific to identify platforms as opposed to an area that was zoned for that purpose. But again, she may be able to help.
Yeah, I think I read that there were building platforms identified.
There possibly have been platforms identified at the time that subdivision took place. So you had the zoning first, then subdivision, which may have identified platforms.
All right. When we talk about the first district plan, what's the kind of time period we're talking about?
Well, the district plan was notified in October 1995.
95, okay. And airport or aerodrome activities in 1995, were they of the scale and extent of today? You know, did we have the range of activities occurring in the area?
I honestly don't know. Mr. Buckley might be able to help you. He's been involved with aeroplanes in the district for quite some time. I expect that probably given passage of 20 years that back in 95 we probably didn't have potentially the number of operators for the extent of operations that we have here today? What would be expected with the growth in population and tourism in the district?
Right. Now, the just popping back by name into the process for developing licenses and leases and whatnot. Do you understand that that will be a process where it's restricted to engagement between the users of the aerodrome and the council, or will it be broader in terms of enabling Waiuna, the interest group, to have a say about the content of those leases or licences?
I expect the initial exchange of information will just be between the council and the operators. Beyond that, and Ms. Galvazi may be able to help you with inquiring authority, she's in charge of that process. It may well be that the intention to then grant a legal licence is notified, which would provide the opportunity for participation by other parties.
That would be a fairly usual process where if the council was going to grant a licence to make use of a part of a designated area, it would notify and seek submissions on that, or?
For a designated area or in terms of a reserve?
A reserve, to utilise a reserve? It was going to grant a lease later to operate a camping ground.
Okay. I've been involved in one lately, actually over in Wanaka for the AMP showground, and the AMP wanted to erect a substantially larger building on the site than at present, and the intention to grant the lease was notified in that case, and I actually thought it was not sure who was too happy about it.
Mm. And they have an opportunity to put their view forward.
Yes, and I would add that, management plan could see it as the council has a set of my submission, there's an obligation to comply with that plan.
Mm-hmm. Alright. Now, as I read Ms. Galavanzi's evidence on the point on the extent of what should be included in the visitation, she's less than enthusiastic about the idea of extending. So when I read that view for and on behalf of the requiring authority, put that alongside your resident group, your group submission, and what's your view about what weighting I should attach to what she's telling me on behalf of the requiring authority vis-a-vis what your interest group expresses?
Well, my short answer is that the council hasn't, as far as I'm aware, consulted with the users in terms of what the operational requirements are.
But does it have to?
Well, I would have thought that it should. I mean, this is a facility that's there for the use of members of the public. As much as it is public work, the council itself isn't operating the public work per se. It's not flying aircraft in and out of there, it's providing a facility for the public to use. And I would have thought that it's going to be of greater benefit to the community, then they should be asking the community what it is that they think it should provide for. As I say, it just doesn't make sense to me that there, for example, there is the reserve management plan with these objectives to consolidate activities, etc. The council has an opportunity to do that by its designation and make it easy for these operators to relocate buildings. Otherwise, they face potentially quite an expensive and uncertain process under the district plan, to identify new building locations and relocate buildings into a common area.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously we are talking to Ms. Galavazi about these points, but it might be leaving aside your point about the sensibleness of the council consulting with the users of the aerodrome, council can adopt the stance of simply saying, we don't want expansion, so we'll just leave it there. And it might be quite a deliberate strategy on behalf of the council to say, if users want to expand, they have to go through a resource consenting process, and that will enable all elements of the community to have their say, because an expansion could lead to effects on the entire community. That could be a deliberate strategy, couldn't it?
It could be. My suspicion is more so it's a misinformed one, because there are helipads that aren't even within the footprint of the designation, and presumably that the intention of what the designation is to capture, even on small scale data evidence, to allow their takeoff and landing of aircraft, and they haven't even got the helipads in there. And it just seems to me that they say you haven't given the time and thought that they should do to what the footprint should be. Again, I'm sorry, Ms. Jones has it in her evidence too, and Mr. Buckley, parking of aircraft outside of the strip proper, refueling, these are all basic operational requirements that are not intended to be there to enable an increase in the intensity and scale, that are operational matters.
Now, the point you made about the definition of aerodrome, as I understand the submission, you're leveraging off the definition of aerodrome to sort of try and give some parameters about the extent of the designation. But does that necessarily follow just because I've got a definition of aerodrome on the plan, I should pick that up and apply it to this designation? Does the definition trump other things that I should be?
No, I don't think it does. I think the intention there was just to say that it provides a broad umbrella in terms of a definition of the type of activity that you might expect in an aerodrome, and my clients are saying that these activities happen at this aerodrome, and it's more than just a footprint for the airstrip proper.
Now, another point, in terms of aircraft or flight movements and flight paths and the like, and the designation, do you have a view about what's covered by the designation? What I'm driving at is, does the designation cover or provide for the taking off of aircraft from the strip? But does it also provide for those aircraft flying in the vicinity of the strip? What's the scope of the designation?
My answer to that would be it covers the actual taking off of the aircraft. So essentially once they're in the air, that's where the designation currently ends in terms of control.
So once they are in the air, they've taken off from the airstrip, then the designation is no longer relevant to aircraft movement. And aircraft noise and things like that.
That's right.
And you were thinking about it and looking for various authorities, can you think of any reason why a baseline approach shouldn't apply?
No, and I must say that I agree with the submission made by Councillor and the case I provided. that you were there, which you know, the judge had stated in his analysis of it.
The submissions, the evidence from the way Una submitter submitters results and some, you know, recommendations for inclusion of conditions related to noise management plans and the like. In the position for your submitter group, is there a sort of similar outcome where you'd be saying, well, either there's no need for conditions, or alternatively there should be a condition that leases and licences get developed relating to the intensity of use of the aerodrome, you know, as soon as possible, or where does that sort of element finish?
Well, I think we're saying that that's where the control is, with the leases and licences, so yes, I think it's in the interest of everybody that they do get developed and put in place as soon as possible.
Well, in terms of my role in dealing with the designation then, what's your view about a sensible outcome of this process? Choices I've got, I just say, well, this is all fine and dandy, they're getting on with it and I won't do a thing about it, or what would your view be as to how I should approach that issue?
Well, I don't think that you can impose a condition on the designation that controls or seeks to influence how the verdict process of the management plan and management licences is going to take place or a timeframe for it. It may well be that there's an advice note that says, you know, refers to that process and the expectations. At least then, if something untoward happens, you know, there's the ability to come back and revisit this designation and condition by way of a variation.
Yeah, so there's a level of uncertainty, isn't there, about the whole issue and this process, with its limitations, provides an opportunity to do something about that, or just let the status quo carry on.
Mm. So I think the problem with doing something about it as part of the designation process is that there isn't the information available.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, everybody acknowledges that.
Mm-hmm.
Despite there being a legal or existing use and effect, it's a matter of determining what that is. And I think the danger of imposing conditions or noise management plans at this stage, as I said in my submission, is that, you know, impose controls that are more restrictive than what's occurring there at the moment.
Thank you very much, that's been very helpful.
Thank you. Mr. Buckley, to come up to the table. Prime Minister Buckley has got a summary already saying for you too that he has to answer any questions that you might have or come about him.
All right, thanks very much. Mr. Buckley, I've read your evidence. So I've just really a few questions to ask you coming out of that evidence. In terms of activities that occur on site, are there any kind of engine testing or engine repairs that are undertaken to aircraft or helicopters?
I would say no. When we get our maintenance done in Wanaka, but say for helicopters or the guys that operate on site, they'll get their maintenance done off site. But if there's anything perhaps off schedule that needed an engineer to come out to the field, then perhaps. But we haven't had to do it. No. And I would hesitate to say that if we had to do it, it wouldn't be it's not a long-winded process. But no, usually just the engines running operationally.
Okay. And in terms of the numbers of different entities utilising the aerodrome at the moment, I kind of struggle to understand that. Are there a number of different entities that use the aerodrome, different sort of clubs or...?
I wouldn't say there's any clubs, but there is a lot of commercial operators use it not to operate from as such, but do you want some examples? So obviously there's ourselves, the Northie Helicopters there, the hang gliding in the winter, who regularly use it and base ourselves there. In the winter there's a lot of heli skiing, originates from the airfield, the people get driven out in vans and the helicopters will go up and down taking them up and dropping them off at the end of the day, coming back for fuel perhaps. There's a lot of operators that go to Milford Sound who bring passengers in to drop them off at Glenorchy, mainly probably for the Dart River, to go and do the jet boating as well. And a lot of people who, well, I wouldn't say, I don't know about a lot, but originate people from Lampert Bay come up and use the airstrip to go to Milford Sound from. So yeah, a lot of Milford Sound hop trips do go via Glenorchy, and other, I don't know about commercial operators, but a lot of private aircraft that do white baiting on the west coast and come to Glenorchy, pick up supplies rather than fly all the way to Queenstown, sort of thing. So yeah, I think I put in here at least about 10 that I know of, but you know, if you went through, there'd be more likely every commercial operator in Queenstown goes to Glenorchy at some point during the year. But how often, I wouldn't know.
Right, so in any one year, how many operators would be utilising the aerodrome?
If I count private planes, could be 50, but I can't, because I'm not there all the time, I don't see all the people that go in. It could be more than that, could be less, but commercial operators, probably everyone who has a helicopter or a fixed wing business in Queenstown would use it at some point, and how often.
Okay, and is there, during the course of the year, is there a peak period of operations, winter, summer?
I would say summer. Summer's generally busier for general aviation in general, but the seasons bring different operators, you see. So in the winter, the hang gliding comes along because they can't go up the mountain here and launch, so they operate there. The heli skiers, obviously they won't run in the summer, but then the tourism business goes all year round, but it is definitely busier in the summer. So it's a sightseeing type of traveller, which is more often than the others. So on balance, I'd say the summer.
Yeah. Okay, and you're present during the summer busy period at the aerodrome?
Yes.
Right, so in either on a daily or a weekly basis, can you give me some kind of understanding of the level of aircraft movements to and from the aerodrome?
Just for us or everybody?
For all of the operators that you've described.
Okay. It's a tricky question because it's very weather dependent.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's assume that's the best weather conditions.
So every day is available. I'd say 25 to 35 movements a day. We ourselves would do, well, yeah, I mean, I don't count, so I'm just, I'm sort of plucking numbers out really. But we do ourselves up to 15 a day.
Okay, and of those movements, you've given me a descriptor about purpose, sightseeing, further afield and matters of that sort. I would say, let's just stick with a number at the moment of 25 or 30 per day. I want to better understand of that number, how many of those movements would result in, can I just say, aircraft activity over the settled area of Glenorchy, as distinct from aircraft leaving the aerodrome and heading off to a further away point.
Well, ourselves and the helicopter company who base ourselves here, and the 10 Glenorchy Museum of Winter, we will stay away from the town.
Yeah.
Other aircraft operators, I can't be sure, the legal requirement, say, for coming in to land or take off out of the airstrip is that flying over the town isn't off limits. But we don't do it ourselves, but the helicopters don't do it, and the angler doesn't do it. So it doesn't mean that someone from another company doesn't, because they don't, they don't operate there as often as we do.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps don't have the same, care for operating in the area, perhaps. So I don't know in regards to other operators what they do.
All right, and in terms of controls of activities at the aerodrome, is there sort of something like a flight intentions book, or is there some level of record kept of the comings and goings by these range of persons, or no? Now, the information that's sought in this letter of the 7th of October from the Queenstown Lakes District Council, for your organisation, is that information readily available? Have you had a quick look at that letter?
If I can have a quick read now.
Yes, please. Yes, the information that the writer seeks.
Yes, could take a while to put it together, but yes, well, I could get that.
All right. Okay. Now, Mr. Galavazzi and her evidence, in terms of issues that might be caused by flying aircraft in relation to effects on residents talks about something called a fly neighbourly guideline. What's that?
So that was developed by a helicopter association in America. I guess they developed it so that they give it to helicopter operators who were perhaps new to the business or new to the industry to develop noise mitigation procedures, I guess, so that you don't upset people with your aircraft noise.
Is it applicable to other types of aircraft other than helicopters?
Well, I had a quick look through it, and I guess some of it you could, yes. But it's more to do with, and there's a lot of stuff in there with noise monitored from helicopters.
Alright. In the background material evidence I read about concern on behalf of the Wyoming residents about hand gliders, I think it was, or some form of gliding where the glider was towed up and they circled up, and there was complaint about that sort of level of noise arising from that activity in particular. So you're familiar with the activity I'm describing?
Mm-hmm.
Is there an operational reason that you're aware of as to why that activity has to occur above settled or populated areas?
No, I don't believe it does, but no.
Okay, well, yeah. So your first response might be you're not sure that it actually does occur above settled areas, and your second response is that as you understand the activity, it's not necessary that it occur above a settled area.
I don't think it needs to.
So it could occur out over the lake, for example.
Well, that's probably the biggest thing that I can think of that would be the issue, would be over the lake, is the chance of not getting back to the land, perhaps. I don't know. When we fly over the lake as well, I guess if something went wrong in the wrong place at the wrong time, the aircraft might not be able to make it back to the land.
Designation was developed in the way you suggest in terms of the plan that's attached to your evidence. Do you see that a likely outcome of such development would be an increase in use of the aerodrome?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, because because the way I've got it is that only the current operators are on there, but I guess the worry is if someone else wants to come along, but the current operators are there. We're not looking to do any more work, just a more, I say, hanging apart the plane, and it just sits outside in the weather all year. The helicopters don't like the same. I guess the other thing I'd like is the parachute landing area. That's where it says PLA. Because currently skydivers have to land on the airstrip, which renders it unusable for the time that they are on it. And it's sort of not a legal, but it's not the normal something to use to land on the east, you know, Scott, I was landing on the airstrip. So, yeah, I don't see us doing any more than we're not, you know, no, the answer to your question.
And leveraging off some of the points made in legal submissions, if the designation was extended to include the ability to add these enhancements, buildings, roads and the like, access road, car park, would it be the intention of your group and others that they would fund those works?
I think so.
You think so?
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much. That's been helpful. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I have read through your evidence a number of times, so unless you've got anything you want to add to that.
No, I was going to give you a summary, but I feel comfortable just taking it as read. Thinking in terms of completeness, the only thing I'd like to add to that evidence was an acknowledgement as well that I cited the wrong section.
Sure.
In haste. Also, that I refer to no-fly zones, and I guess that's more accurately, you know, I should have referred more to a condition of operators to follow the fly neighbourly guidelines, so just a small point there. And at paragraph 6.1 of my evidence, where I list the sorts of breach of consent that may be required depending on sort of works, I also should note there that a licence or lease would also be required, and that's just to, I guess, round out that conversation about education and whether it's necessary. Mm. So otherwise, yep, take it as read and check it out. Any questions?
I want to take you to your paragraph 6.5. And just firstly, let me just talk about that, and a question will percolate out of that. It seems to me that there's a real tension between actually what's in the reserve management plan currently and what the submitter's proposing. And this is echoed in Mrs. Galavani's evidence when she gets to talk about the point of, well, why the council doesn't want to expand. She talks about, or makes reference to, the point that the current reserve management plan doesn't see or doesn't support the idea of any increases in activity. It wants to very much retain the status quo. But yet, you know, your paragraph 6.5, you're telling me that, as I read it anyway, effectively what's happening on the ground doesn't match with the reserve management plan. Yet I'm stuck with the reserve management plan, if you like, in terms of how that informs the scope of the designation. So my question is the real issue here that for whatever reason, what's happening on the ground isn't in conformity with the reserve management plan, and that's what's really driving the submission?
Well, I mean, I see the reserve management plan has that overriding, the intensity, scale and nature of the activity on the ground at the time that the RMP was approved, which was only, you know, a couple of months ago. Should be allowed to continue.
Well, it's kind of a bit more than should be allowed to continue, isn't it? Isn't it expressed as a restraint?
Well, it's a restraint in terms of intensity, nature and scale. but there's also Jeff Engel policies talking about things like consolidating buildings, which to me indicates that they want some of that scattering of buildings, scattering of structures, whatever, to be consolidated, which to me would indicate nature and scale of those buildings should be same or similar, but we would rather they were clustered in a particular area.
But what, okay, but teasing that out, if we accept reserve management plan is about a restraint, no increase, keep the status quo.
Yes, but then it says all sorts of other things.
All right.
And how intends that to happen.
Okay, let's just tease that out. Let's start with the position that it wants to, its major thrust, its critical thrust is preservation of the status quo at the time the RMP was settled. Do you accept that?
Yeah, I guess there's a, in terms of nature, yes, nature, scale and intensity, that's not the same to my thinking as exactly where the buildings go, exactly what they might look like.
Right, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But I just want your view, when you read the reserve management plan, the thing, what I'm saying to you is the thing that struck me about it was, it was saying, we want to hold development of this site. We don't want an increase.
It eventually at your existing use rights, more or less, which has got to be determined.
Yeah, so that's what I read from the management plan. The first question for you is, do you agree that that's the critical signal, the overall thrust of the plan, reserve management plan? Right. Okay, so if somebody comes along and then says, well, I'd like to put a new building on the site, that seems to be, to my way of thinking, counter to that thrust.
That's not how I would read it, particularly with a replacement structure.
No, a new
a
building.
A new additional building? Well,
I want to put a new hangar on the site, thank you.
Well, this is where it's a little bit grey. I mean, at the moment, I probably would agree with you that is beyond the intensity, nature and scale. However, there is currently, say, an aircraft part there, which arguably should or shouldn't be parked on rural. Probably find that it is parked there.
But there's no hangar.
But there's no hangar. Is that changing the nature and intensity of the activity? It's not increasing the numbers, it's not increasing the fact that that particular plane sits there 24/7, is putting a structure around it. So that's then something for the leasing or licensing process.
I understand. You don't necessarily have to voyage into leases and licenses. I just really want to concentrate on the reserve management plan for now. Now, you're a planner and your expertise is valuable to me to understand how I should interpret the reserve management plan. So, where is the provision under Ms. Galavan's use evidence? She says that 833, council does not have any intention to carry out purpose of designation, permission to take off and land. The council clearly stated in the management plan that one of the objectives for the reserve is ensure that the nature, scale and intensity of the use remains generally unchanged. So I read that and I thought, well, I'm asking the question, and you are agreeing with me, that that's the major thrust of the reserve management plan.
Yes,
but
it's not clear in my mind whether it's
if somebody wants to come along and put a new building on the site, on the aerodrome, they would run foul of that. Those words.
No, I think those words mimic what I agree, remain generally unchanged.
Right. So again, if I want to put a hangar on the site, am I not running straight into a brick wall in terms of these words?
Potentially. Again, it's that issue of whether they feel that building over the parked plane is within, it wouldn't be within their existing use right as far as their amazement is concerned, whether it's within the bounds of the objectives of the RMP. It's a little grey, but I guess with my RMA hat on, I would tend to say no, it's changing the nature and scale as far as RMA thinking is concerned.
Right. And that's the relevant thinking, isn't it?
As far as if we're getting away from how the RMP process would work and thinking about this as an objective under the RMA, then.
And in terms of change, Ms. Galvardi, the next paragraph, 834, obviously she's alive to the point there is pressure for change, and she says, well, the preferred method for change is resource consent.
Mm.
And I know in your evidence you pointed out the difficulty of getting a resource consent, but isn't there a real benefit that persons who may be affected by increase in nature scale or intensity of activities on the Eurogrome can be heard?
Yes, I think there's two sides to here. There are the aspects like hangar,
yep.
Which yes, may well, the rest of the consent process may well be the best process for that.
Sure.
Then there's all the other things like the PLA, the ability to park a plane off the airstrip so it can be loaded, those sorts of things, the ability to replace an old building or an old trailer eventually with a permanent building. Those are the things that more I feel really are wholly within the existing nature scale and intensity and compliant with the objectives of the RMP. It should not be required to go through a resource consent process.
Alright, so if we go back to the plan then, attached to Mr. Buckley's evidence. And here I'm referring to attachment A. Is it your position then that, can I use the phrase additions, that some of the additions he suggests better fit into a resource consenting process and some better fit into alteration of the designation process? And if so, which belongs where?
I would say with the exception of the new hangar, which is substantial structures, I would think that the rest is within the bounds of I think all of what he's suggesting there is within the bounds of what I would anticipate being appropriate under an airport or aerodrome, but under the objectives of the RMP, which are essentially sort of our guiding light here, I would think that the new large hangar structures would be over and above the existing nature and scale and intensity of built form at least, but that the rest I think would be within the bounds of what is occurring.
So, hangar then for resource consent process. Everything else on attachment A, they could be dealt with by refinements to the designation. Is that?
Mm-hmm. And including things you haven't got here, they're just illegible on my copy, in terms of, say, the helipads.
Right. And he's got access roads, toilets, car park.
Yeah, I mean the access road is specifically mentioned in the reserve management plan,
right.
As is the consolidation of buildings, which to me indicates that the expectation is that existing buildings would be redeveloped and consolidated.
Yeah, but the hangar that he's referred to here, just so I understand, I have been on the site, I've looked at the aerodrome, I didn't think there was a hangar on site.
No, I understand. No. I don't believe there is.
Okay.
So you may need to just double check that, Mr. Buckley. There's not a hangar there.
Is that right, Mr. Buckley? No hangars?
We're a lot drawn.
Yes.
No, not just our building.
Right.
well, children of the trailer,
Porticom. Yeah, Porticom with wee deck outside, yeah. And there's a few other scattered structures around, but there's no hangar on site, is there? I'm challenged by the words in the RMP. The nature, scale and intensity of the use of the airstrip remain generally, and the words are, and I've underlined them, unchanged from the level. So, I'm struggling with that.
Well, we need to understand what that's right.
There are 2 points. We need to understand what the existing level is. But leaving that aside, I read those words as sending a clear signal that it doesn't anticipate additional and or further development.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
Specifically talk about the use of the airstrip, whether adding, in terms of talking about just the reserve management plan and the reserve deck, and the subjective whether adding, putting a hangar over a that has always sat there and has a system you trust to sit there and be used, that is actually changing the nature, scale and intensity of the use of the airstrip just simply because it's covered by a structure. It's questionable in my view under what the RMP was intending. I think the focus of without it doesn't expect there to be an increase in the use of the airstrip in terms of aircraft movement. Yeah, but just to add to that, the RMP is headed future development, which to me indicates there is an expectation there will be development of the aerodrome, talking about new buildings and new development being consolidated and being of a low key nature.
I agree, but when I look at it, I've got it open in front of me, and so if I take you to the executive summary and the bullet points about the summary of the management plan, wording like no further intensification of the reserve is proposed. Then I take you to under the heading, sorry, I don't have, sorry, it's page 4, under the heading runway and operational features, airstrip. No upgrade of the airstrip facility is planned, nor is evidence from consultation with communities in favour of intensification of use that may lead to an upgrade. I'm saying that they, as I read them, I see them as really compelling messages, and I want your view. Do you agree with that, or am I somehow misinterpreting the RMP?
No, I mean, I do agree with those two extracts. I've got them highlighted here in mine as well. I guess I've just been focusing on what's been transpired into the objectives and policies, even though I realise it needs to be read as a whole. And you know, some of the things that it talks about and suggests is about, you know, maximising use of the airstrip and ensuring safe use of the airstrip. Some of those things actually require some of the activities that are occurring on the airstrip right now to be relocated off the airstrip and to be allowed to occur off the airstrip, like the PLA and the refueling, loading passengers. Some of that stuff is integral to using the airstrip and seems to be supported by the RMP that those things can occur off the airstrip. Over here, it's a little bit grey in terms of structures and yeah, I think back to the hangar, you know, in terms of even though there's no clear messages in the objectives about that I can recall in terms of the nature and scale of the structures themselves, those other bits that you pulled out, yeah, they certainly indicate that there will, you know, against any intensification of the reserve beyond the airstrip.
Sure. Well, which parts then of the policy would you direct me to? Or in other words, what parts do you rely on for the basis of the evidence that you've produced?
I'm sort of paraphrasing my evidence, but it might be. Any part of the policy?
Any part of the reserve management plan that you want to refer to as fine?
So in the actual evidence, I refer to the various policies in my paragraph 7.7. The relevant objectives.
Yep.
Which talk about facilitate the existing aviation activities. Aviation activities are managed in a way that provides for the airstrip to be sustained into the future, and it's the nature and scale intensity of the use of the airstrip remain generally unchanged, as we've discussed.
Mm-hmm.
The reserve is managed and maintained so that the airstrip is safe to use.
Mm-hmm.
The reserve is managed and maintained so that the use remains compatible with the surrounding environment.
Mm-hmm.
Aviation activities will be coordinated in a way that maximises the airstrip's use and enjoyment for users at maintaining, and enjoyment for all users at maintaining the level of intensity that exists from the date of adoption of this plan. The airstrip will be maintained to a standard that promotes use by all approved aviation activities. And the reserve is managed and developed in a manner that maintains its use as an airstrip in balance with the maintaining the amenity of the site and surrounds. And then some of the policies sort of bring in some additional, which I have, as I say, I've paraphrased in my 7.10, but I can go through the REP and pull those out if you prefer.
Mm-hmm.
Page 5. We've got policies about managing the airstrip in a manner that permits and promotes a mixture of uses.
Yes.
So to me that is about ensuring that the airstrip itself is free of people that are something dropped in their parachutes to enable someone else to take off.
Mm-hmm.
Regulate the use of the reserve in a manner that ensures that nature and scale intensity of the airstrip is generally unchanged. Activities that existed prior to this plan must apply for leases, so that's establish the safe and suitable legal vehicle access from the Queensland and Lockheed Road to the reserve to the airstrip. Under that there is to be safe and secure storage of fuel on site to prevent pollution from spillage or increased fire risk. We've got the encourage all users to avoid undertaking circuit flights to the Northern Township and surrounding residential areas of the airstrip and limit the hours of operation for leases and licences for takeoffs and landings from morning civil twilight to evening civil twilight. Under future development, we've got ensure all buildings on site are low-key, low-visibility and commensurate with the degree of use of the reserve. where your new development encourages consolidation of replacement structures in one area, building on size and scale to the combined footprint area of those existing at the time of adoption of this plan, and ensure development complies with relevant district plan provisions, including future designation conditions. And so I think that second to last policy just does probably confirm the discussion we've been having about the hangars. You know, to my mind, that's not foreseen by the RMP objectives and policy.
No, that's been very helpful, thank you. This process, I have from time to time been asking the reporting officer as we go if there's any particular comments that she wants to make, particularly while you're present, while the submissions are present, because the process about any replies and matters of that sort is particularly the submitters have been a little interesting and challenging in this space. The requiring authorities at this hearing, they have the ability to reply, but submitters not so. So to sort of look at that circumstance, I've asked the reporting officer from time to time, after hearing what's been exchanged between us, whether she's got any particular comment to make, and then I've returned to submitters to say, well, you know, do you have any further response? Now, sometimes that's not worked particularly well because the hearings officer isn't in a position to respond as we go, but that's what I'd like to do now. If that's so, having heard the conversation, any particular points that you want to sort of draw out? And,
it's just reinforces what I've written in my section 42A report, that it's just that lack of really discussion at the level of baseline information mm-hmm. to enable to identify what the actual scale and intensity of the existing activity is. Also, this duplication between the designation, the purpose of the designation is for the takeoff and landing of aircraft to facilitate that. But then under the Reserves Act, that encompasses the whole site and that's vested in council's local purpose airport. So I do agree that that needs to be corrected in the schedule of designation. But I think that there are two different pieces of legislation that have different purposes. So I think for a lot of the conditions that submitters are seeking to impose on designation, I think they're better placed or managed under the Reserves Act.
So just teasing out that point, you see the designation as being restricted purely to the landing and taking off of aircraft. That's the way you see the scope of the designation.
That's what I see. Yeah. So I guess the comment made about taking the takeoff of the helicopter pad not being within the designation, I do think there's some argument in that. That to be included,
Alrighty. Well, any points arising for you there?
No,
I just think PJ got Sure. No, I've understood from the evidence and the submissions what the position of the submitter is. I've got Ms. Galavanti still to come. I've arranged a queries and questions of her along a similar line that we've had a conversation about this morning. So probably all things considered, in terms of rights of reply and matters of that sort, there's possibly not a lot more in it, as it were.
Alright,
yep, no, thank you very much, that's been very helpful. Alright, now, we'll take a break now for morning tea for 10 minutes, and then we're going to resume with the Waiuna Residents Association. And we've got Mr. Ferguson, Marie Baker Galloway, and Mr. Malcolm Hunt.
Yeah.
All right, okay. So 10 minute break, and we'll come back and carry on. Thank you.